Stephen said as how he was struggling to get into his wet breeches, all soused with blood like they were. And he looked up and saw her laying still as a stone on the floor, but with her belly still wriggling and twitching like a bag full of snakes. Said it come to him sudden that the babe meant to come out and take its revenge on him, and he fled the house right then in his shirt, leaving his breeches behind. She chortled at this amusing vision, then snorted and settled herself, brushing down her skirts. "But then Stephen's Irish," she added tolerantly. "They take morbid fancies, the Irish, especially when they're gone in drink." The tip of her tongue came out and passed reminiscently over her lower lip, tasting the lingering traces of Bonnet's liquor. Brianna leaned closer, holding out her hand. "Look." Hepzibah glanced into her hand, then looked again, riveted. The thick gold band with its big cabochon ruby winked and glowed in the lantern light. "I'll give it to you," Brianna said, lowering her voice, "if you'll do something for me." The whore licked her lips again, a sudden look of alertness coming into her heavy face. "Aye, do what?" "Get word to my husband. He's in Edenton, at the Reverend Macmillan's house. Anyone will know where it is. Tell him where I am, and tell him—" She hesitated. What should she say? There was no telling how long the anemone would stay here, or where Bonnet would choose to go next. The only clue she had was what she had overheard in his conversation with his mate just before he came in. "Tell them I think he has a hiding place on Ocracoke. He means to rendezvous with someone there at the dark of the moon. Tell him that." Hepzibah cast an uneasy glance at the cabin door, but it stayed shut. She looked back at the ring, longing for it, warring in her face with an obvious fear of Bonnet. "He won't know," Brianna urged. "He won't find out. And my father will reward you."
"He's a rich man, then, your father?"
Brianna saw the look of calculation in the whore's eyes and felt a moment's misgiving. What if she should simply take the ring and betray her to Bonnet? Still, she hadn't taken more money than her due. Perhaps she was honest. And there was no choice, after all.
"Very rich," she said firmly. "His name is Jamie Fraser. My aunt is rich, too. She has a plantation called River Run, just above Cross Creek in North Carolina. Ask for Mrs. Innes, Jocasta Cameron Innes." "Yes. If you don't find my husband, send word there."
"River Run," Hepzibah repeated it obediently, eyes still fixed on the ring.
Brianna twisted it off and dropped it into the whore's palm before she could change her mind. The woman's hand closed tight around it.
"My father's name is Jamie Fraser. My husband is Roger Mackenzie," she repeated, "at the Reverend Macmillan's house. Can you remember?"
"Fraser and Mackenzie," Hepzibah repeated uncertainly. "Oh, aye, to be sure."
She was already moving toward the door.
"Please,"
Brianna said urgently. The whore nodded, but without looking at her, then sidled through the door, shutting it behind her. The ship creaked and swayed underfoot, and she heard the rattle of wind through the trees on the shore, over the shouts of drunken men. Her knees gave way then, and she sat down on the bed, careless of the sheets. They left with the tide. She heard the anchor chain rumble and felt the ship quicken, taking life as her sails took wind. Glued to the window, she watched the dark green mass of Roanoke recede. 100 years before, the first English colony had landed here and disappeared without trace. The governor of the colony, returning from England with supplies, had found everyone gone, leaving no clue save the word Croatan carved into the trunk of a tree. She wasn't even leaving that much. Heartsick, she watched until the island sank into the sea. No one came for some hours. Empty-bellied, she grew nauseated and threw up in the chamber pot. She couldn't bear the thought of lying down on those revolting sheets, but instead pulled them off, remade the bed with only the quilts, and lay down. The windows were open, and the fresh air of the sea stirred her hair and lifted the clamminess from her skin, making her feel a little better. She was unbearably conscious of her womb, a small, heavy, tender weight, and what was likely happening inside it. That orderly dance of dividing cells, a sort of peaceful violence, implacably wresting lives and wrenching hearts. When had it happened? She tried to think back, remember. It might have been the night before Roger left for Edenton. He'd been excited, almost exalted, and they had made love with lingering joy, spiced by longing, for they both knew the morrow would bring separation. She had fallen asleep in his arms, feeling loved. But then she had waked alone in the middle of the night to find him sitting by the window, bathed in the light of a gibbous moon. She'd been reluctant to disturb his private contemplation, but he had turned, feeling her eyes on him, and something in his look had made her get out of bed and go to him, taking his head against her bosom, holding him. He had risen then, laid her on the floor, and had her again, wordless and urgent. Catholic that she was, she had found it terribly erotic, the notion of seducing a priest on the eve of his ordination, stealing him, if only for a moment, from God. She swallowed, hands clasped over her belly. "Be careful what you pray for." The nuns at school had always told the children that. The wind was growing cold, chilling her, and she pulled the edge of one quilt, the cleanest, over her. Then, concentrating fiercely, she began, very carefully, to pray. Chapter 103. Put to the Question. Neil Forbes sat in the parlour of the King's Inn, enjoying a glass of hard cider, and the feeling that all was right with the world. He had had a most fruitful meeting with Samuel Iredell and his friend, two of the most prominent rebel leaders in Edenton, and an even more fruitful meeting with Gilbert Butler and William Lyons, local smugglers. He had a great fondness for jewels, and in private celebration of his elegant disposal of the threat of Jamie Fraser, he had bought a new stickpin, topped with a beautiful ruby. He contemplated this with quiet satisfaction, noting the lovely shadows that the stone cast on the silk of his ruffle. His mother was safely planted at her sister's house. He had an appointment for luncheon with a local lady, and an hour to spare beforehand. Perhaps a stroll to stimulate appetite. It was a beautiful day. He had, in fact, pushed back his chair and begun to rise, when a large hand planted itself in the centre of his chest and shoved him back into it. What? He looked up in indignation, and took great care to keep that expression on his face, despite a sudden deep qualm. A tall, dark man was standing over him, wearing a most unfriendly expression. Mackenzie, the chit's husband.
"How dare you, sir?" he said belligerently. "I must demand apology."
"You demand what you like," Mackenzie said.
He was pale under his tan and grim.
"Where is my wife?"
"How should I know?"
Forbes's heart was beating fast, but with glee as much as trepidation. He lifted his chin and made to rise.
"You will excuse me, sir."
A hand on his arm stopped him, and he turned, looking into the face of Fraser's nephew, Ian Murray. Murray smiled, and Forbes's sense of self-satisfaction diminished slightly.
"They said the boy had lived with the Mohawk, become one of them,
that he dwelt with a vicious wolf who spoke to him and obeyed his commands, that he had cut a man's heart out and eaten it in some heathen ritual." Looking at the lad's homely face and dishevelled dress, though, Forbes wasn't impressed.
"Remove your hand from my person, sir,"
he said with dignity, straightening in his chair.
"No, I think I won't," Murray said.
The hand tightened on his arm like the bite of a horse, and Forbes's mouth opened, though he made no sound.
"What have you done with my cousin?" Murray said.
"I've nothing whatever to do with Mrs. Mackenzie. Let go, goddamn you."
The grip relaxed, and he sat breathing heavily. Mackenzie had pulled up a chair to face him and sat down. Forbes smoothed the sleeve of his coat, avoiding Mackenzie's stare and thinking rapidly. How would they find out? Or had they? Perhaps they were only trying a venture with no sure knowledge.
"I am grieved to hear that any misfortune might have befallen Mrs. Mackenzie," he said politely. "Am I to take it that you have somehow misplaced her?"
Mackenzie looked him up and down for a moment without answering, then made a small sound of contempt.
"I heard you speak in Mecklenburg," he said, his tone conversational. "Very glib you were. A great deal about justice, I heard, and protection of our wives and children. Such eloquence."
"Fine talk," Ian Murray put in, "for a man who would abduct a helpless woman." He was still crouching on the floor like a savage, but had moved round a little, so as to stare directly into Forbes's face. The lawyer found it slightly unnerving, and chose instead to meet Mackenzie's eyes, man to man.
"I regret your misfortune extremely, sir," he said, striving for a tone of concern. "I should be pleased to help in any way possible, of course, but I do not. Where is Stephen Bonnet?"
The question struck Forbes like a blow to the liver. He gaped for a moment, thinking that he had made a mistake in choosing Mackenzie to look at. That flat green gaze was like a snake's.
"Who is Stephen Bonnet?" he asked, licking his lips.
His lips were dry, but the rest of him was heavily bedewed. He could feel sweat pooling in the creases of his neck, soaking the cambric of his shirt beneath his oxters.
"I heard you, Ken," Murray remarked pleasantly, "when you made the bargain with Richard Brown. In your warehouse, it was."
Forbes's head snapped round. He was so shocked that it was a moment before he realised that Murray was holding a knife, laid casually across his knee.
"What? You say, what? I tell you, sir, you are mistaken. Mistaken."
He half rose, stammering. Mackenzie shot to his feet and seized him by the shirt front, twisting.
"No, sir," he said very softly,
his face so close that Forbes felt the heat of his breath.
"It is yourself has been mistaken, most grievously mistaken, and choosing my wife to serve your wicked ends."
There was a ripping sound as the fine cambric tore. Mackenzie shoved him back violently into the chair, then leaned forward, seizing his neckcloth in a grip that threatened to choke him on the spot. His mouth opened, gasping, and black spots flickered in his vision, but not sufficiently as to obscure those brilliant, cold green eyes.
"Where has he taken her?"
Forbes gripped the arms of his chair, breathing heavily.
"I know nothing about your wife, sir," he said,
his voice pitched low and venomous.
"And as for grievous error, sir, you are in the process of committing one. How dare you assault me? I shall prefer charges, I do assure you." "Oh, assault forby," Murray said, scoffing. "We haven't done any such thing. Yet."
He sat back on his haunches, tapping the knife thoughtfully against his thumbnail, and regarding Forbes with an air of estimation, like one planning to carve a suckling pig on a platter. Forbes set his jaw and glared up at Mackenzie, who was still standing, looming over him.
"This is a public place," he pointed out. "You cannot harm me without notice being taken."
He glanced behind Mackenzie, hoping that someone would come into the parlour and interrupt this grossly uncomfortable tête-à-tête. But it was a quiet morning, and all the chambermaids and ostlers inconveniently about their duties elsewhere.
"Do we care if anyone notices a harridge?"
Murray inquired, glancing up at Mackenzie.
"Not really."
Nonetheless, Mackenzie resumed his seat and resumed his stare.
"We can wait a bit, though."
He glanced at the case clock by the mantel, its pendulum moving with a serene tick-tock.
"It won't be long."
Belatedly, it occurred to Forbes to wonder where Jamie Fraser was. Elspeth Forbes was rocking gently on the veranda of her sister's house, enjoying the coolness of the morning air, when a visitor was announced. "Why, Mr. Fraser," she exclaimed, sitting up. "What brings you to Edenton? Is it Neil you're in search of? He's gone to..."
"Ah, no, Mistress Forbes."
He swept her a low bow, the morning sun gleaming off his hair as though it were bronze metal.
"It is yourself I've come for."
"Oh? Oh?" She sat up in her chair, hastily brushing away crumbs of toast on her sleeve, and hoping her cap was on straight. "Why, sir,
What could you possibly want with an old woman?
He smiled. Such a nice-looking lad he was, so fine in his grey coatie. And that look of mischief in his eyes.
And leaned close to whisper in her ear.
I've come to steal you away, mistress.
Oh, away with you.
She flapped a hand at him, laughing, and he took it, kissing her knuckles.
I shall not take no for answer now, he assured her,
and gestured toward the edge of the porch, where he had left a large, promising-looking basket, covered with a checkered cloth.
I've a mind to eat my luncheon in the country, under a tree. I've the very tree in mind, a braw fine tree, but it's a poor meal taken without company.
Surely to goodness you could find better company than my lad, she said, thoroughly charmed. And where's your dear wife, then?
Ah, she's left me,
he said, affecting sorrow.
Here's me with a wonderful picnic planned, and her off to a birthing. So I said to myself, well, Jamie, it's shame to waste such a feast. Who might be at liberty to share it with you? And what should I see next but your most elegant self taking your ease? An answer to prayer it was. Surely you wouldn't go against heavenly guidance, Mistress Forbes.
Mm-hmm, she said, trying not to laugh at him. Oh, well, if it's a matter of wasting...
Before she could say more, he had stooped down and plucked her from her chair, lifting her in his arms. She whooped with surprise.
If it's a proper abduction, I must carry you away, aye?
He said, smiling down at her. To her mortification, the sound she made could be called nothing but a giggle. He seemed not to mind, though, and, bending to sweep up the basket in one strong hand, carried her, like a bit of thistledown, out to his carriage.
You cannot keep me prisoner here. Let me pass, or I will shout for help.
They had, in fact, kept him for more than an hour, blocking all attempts on his part to rise and leave. He was right, though, Roger thought. Traffic was beginning to pick up in the street outside, and he could hear, as could Forbes, the noises of a maid setting out the tables for dinner in the next room. He glanced at Ian.
They had discussed it. If word hadn't come within an hour, they would have to try to remove Forbes from the inn, take him to a more private place. That could be a dicey business. The lawyer was intimidated, but stubborn as a ball-bearing, and he would call for help.
Ian pursed his lips thoughtfully and drew the knife he had been playing with down the side of his breeches, polishing the blade.
Mr. Mackenzie?
A small boy had popped up beside him like a mushroom, dirt-smeared and round-faced.
I am,
he said, a wave of thankfulness washing through him.
Have you got something for me?
Aye, sir.
The urchin handed over a small twist of paper, accepted a coin in return, and was gone, in spite of Forbes' call of,
Wait, boy!
The lawyer had half risen from his seat in agitation. Roger made a sharp move toward him, though, and he sank back at once, not waiting to be pushed.
Good, Roger thought grimly. He was learning.
Undoing the twist of paper, he found himself holding a large brooch in the shape of a bunch of flowers, done in garnet and silver. It was a good piece of workmanship, but rather ugly. Its impression on Forbes, though, was substantial.
You wouldn't. He wouldn't.
The lawyer was staring at the brooch in Roger's hand, his heavy face gone pale.
Oh, I expect you would, if you mean Uncle Jimmy, Ian Murray said. He's fond of his daughter, aye?
Nonsense!
The lawyer was making a game attempt to bluff it out, but he couldn't keep his eyes off the brooch.
Fraser is a gentleman.
He's a Highlander, Roger said brutally. Like your father, aye?
He'd heard stories about the elder Forbes, who, by all accounts, had escaped Scotland just ahead of the hangman. Forbes chewed his lower lip.
He wouldn't harm an old woman, he said,
with as much bravado as he could summon.
Would he not?
Ian's sketchy brows lifted.
Aye, perhaps not. He might just send her a war, though. To Canada, maybe. You seem to ken him fair weel, Mr. Forbes. What do you think?
The lawyer drummed his fingers on the arm of the chair, breathing through his teeth, evidently reviewing what he knew of Jamie Fraser's character and reputation.
All right, he said suddenly. All right.
Roger felt the tension running through him snap like a cut wire. He'd been strung like a puppet since Jamie had come to fetch him last night.
Where?
He said, feeling breathless.
Where is she? She's safe, Forbes said hoarsely. I wouldn't have her harmed.
He looked up, wild-eyed.
For God's sake, I wouldn't harm her. Where?
Roger clamped the brooch tight, not caring that its edges cut into his hand.
Where is she?
The lawyer sagged like a half-filled bag of meal.
Aboard a ship called Anemone. Captain Bonnet.
He swallowed hard, unable to keep his eyes away from the brooch.
They're bound for England, but she is safe, I tell you.
Shock tightened Roger's grip, and he felt the sudden slick of blood on his fingers. He flung the brooch onto the floor, wiping his hand on his breeches, struggling for words. The shock had tightened his throat as well. He felt as though he was strangling. Seeing his trouble, Ian stood abruptly and pressed his knife against the lawyer's throat.
When did they sail?
The lawyer's mouth opened and closed at random, and he looked helplessly from Ian to Roger, eyes bulging.
Where?
Roger forced the word past the blockage in his throat, and Forbes flinched at the sound.
She was put aboard here in Edenton two days ago.
Roger nodded abruptly.
Safe, he said. In Bonnet's hands. 2 days in Bonnet's hands. But he had sailed with Bonnet, he thought, trying to steady himself, keep a grip on his rationality. He knew how the man worked. Bonnet was a smuggler. He wouldn't sail for England without a full cargo. He might be going down the coast, picking up small shipments, before turning to the open sea and the long voyage for England. And if not, he might still be caught with a fast ship. No time to be lost. People on the docks might know where the Anemone was headed next.
He turned and took a step toward the door. Then a red wave washed through him and he whirled back, smashing his fist into Forbes's face with the full weight of his body behind it. The lawyer gave a high-pitched scream and clutched both hands to his nose. All noises in the inn and in the street seemed to stop. The world hung suspended. Roger took a short, deep breath, rubbing his knuckles, and nodded once more.
"Come on," he said to Ian.
"Oh, aye."
Roger was halfway to the door when he realized that Ian wasn't with him. He looked back and was just in time to see his cousin by marriage take Forbes gently by one ear and cut it off. Chapter 104. Sleeping with a shark. Stephen Bonnet was as good as his word, if that's how one would describe it. He made no sexual advances towards her, but did insist that she share his bed.
"I like a warm body in the night," he said, "and I think you might prefer my bed to the cargo hold, sweetheart."
She would most emphatically have preferred the cargo hold, though her explorations, once free of the land she was allowed out of the cabin, had revealed the hold as a dark and comfortless hole, in which several hapless slaves were chained among a collection of boxes and barrels, in constant danger of being crushed should the cargo shift.
"Where are we going, miss, and what will happen when we get there?"
Josh spoke in Gaelic, his handsome face small and frightened in the shadows of the hold.
"I think we're going to Ocracoke," she said in the same language. "Beyond that, I don't know. Do you still have your rosary?"
"Oh, yes, miss."
He touched his chest where the crucifix hung. "It's the only thing that keeps me from despair."
"Good. Keep praying."
She glanced at the other slaves, two women, two men, all with slender bodies and delicate, fine-boned faces. She had brought food for Josh from her own supper, but had nothing to offer them, and was troubled.
"Do they feed you down here?"
"Yes, miss. Fairly well," he assured her.
"Do they—"
She moved her chin a little, delicately indicating the other slaves.
"Know anything about where we're going?"
"I don't know, miss. I can't talk to them. They're African. Fulani. I
can see that from the way they look, but that's all I know.
I see.
Well, she hesitated, eager to be out of the dark, clammy hold, but reluctant to leave the young groom there.
You go along, miss, he said quietly in English, seeing her doubt. I be fine. We all be fine.
He touched his rosary and did his best to give her a smile, though it wavered round the edges.
Holy Mother, see us safe.
Having no words of comfort to impart, she nodded and climbed the ladder into the sunlight, feeling five sets of eyes upon her. Bonnet, thank God, spent most of his time on deck during the day. She could see him now, coming down the rigging like a nimble ape. She stood very still, no movement save the brush of wind-blown hair, of skirts against her frozen limbs. He was as sensitive to the movements of her body as was Roger, but in his own way, the way of a shark signalled to and drawn by the flappings of its prey. She had spent one night in his bed so far, sleepless. He had pulled her casually against himself, said, "Good night, darling," and fallen instantly asleep. Whenever she had tried to move, to extricate herself from his grip, though, he had shifted, moving with her, to keep her firmly by him. She was obliged to an unwelcome intimacy with his body, an acquaintance that awoke memories she had with great difficulty put away. The feel of his knee pushing her thighs apart, the rough joviality of his touch between her legs, the sun-bleached blonde hairs that curled crisply on his thighs and forearms, the unwashed, musky male smell of him, the mocking presence of Leroy rising at intervals during the night, pressed in firm and mindless hunger against her buttocks. She had a moment of intense thankfulness, both for her present pregnancy, for she was in no doubt of it now, and for her certain knowledge that Stephen Bonnet hadn't fathered Jemmy. He dropped from the rigging with a thud, saw her and smiled. He said nothing, but squeezed her bottom familiarly as he passed, making her clench her teeth and cling to the rail. Ocracoke, at the dark of the moon. She looked up into the brilliant sky, wheeling with clouds of terns and gulls. They couldn't be far offshore. How long, for God's sake, till the dark of the moon? Chapter 105. The Prodigal. They had no trouble in finding persons familiar with Anemone and her captain. Stephen Bonnet was well known on the Edenton docks, though his reputation varied depending on his associations. An honest captain, was the usual opinion, but hard in his dealings. A blockade runner, a smuggler, said others, and whether that was good or bad depended on the politics of the person saying it. He'd get you anything, they said, for a price. Pirate, said a few. But those few spoke in low tones, looking frequently over their shoulders, and strongly desired not to be quoted. The Anemone had left quite openly, with a homely cargo of rice and 50 barrels of smoked fish. Roger had found one man who recalled seeing the young woman go aboard with one of Bonnet's hands. "Great huge doxy with flaming hair a-loose, flowing down to her ass," the man had said, smacking his lips. "Mr. Bonnet's a good-sized man himself, though. Expect he can handle her." Only Ian's hand on his arm had stopped him hitting the man. What they had not yet found was anyone who knew for sure where Anemone was headed.
"London, I think," said the harbour-master, dubious. "But not directly. He's not yet got a full cargo. Likely he'll be going down the coast, trading here and there. Perhaps sail for Europe from Charlestown. But then again," the man added, rubbing his chin, "could be he's bound for New England. Terrible risky business getting anything into Boston these days, but well worth it if you do. Rice and smoked fish like to be worth their weight in gold up there, if you can get it ashore without the Navy's warships blowing you out of the water."
Jamie, looking a little pale, thanked the man. Roger, unable to speak for the knot in his throat, merely nodded, and followed his father-in-law out of the harbour-master's office, back into the sun of the docks.
"Now what?" Ian asked, stifling a belch.
He had been trawling through the dockside taverns, buying beer for casual labourers who might have helped load Anemone, or might have spoken with her hands regarding her destination.
"The best I can think of is maybe for you and Roger Mack to take ship down the coast," Jamie said, frowning at the masts of the sloops and packet boats rocking at anchor. "Claire and I could go up toward Boston."
Roger nodded, still unable to speak. It was far from being a good plan, particularly in light of the disruption the undeclared war was having on shipping. But the need of doing something was acute. He felt as though the marrow of his bones was burning. Only movement would quench it. To hire a small ship, even a fishing smack, or take passage on a packet boat, though, was expensive business.
"I will." Jamie curled his hand in his pocket where the black diamond still lay. "I'll go and see Judge Iredell. He can maybe put me in touch with an honest banker who'll advance me money against the sale of the stone. Let's go and tell Claire what's to do first."
As they turned off the docks, though, a voice hailed Roger.
"Mr. Mackenzie."
He turned to find the Reverend Dr. McCorkle, his secretary, and the Reverend Macmillan carrying bags, all staring at him. There was a brief scuffle of introduction. They had, of course, met Jamie when he came to fetch Roger, but not Ian. Then a slightly awkward pause.
"You..."
Roger cleared his throat, addressing the elder man.
"You're leaving then, sir, for the Indies."
McCorkle nodded, his large, kindly face set in concern.
"I am, sir. I regret so much that I must go, and that you were not able to... well..."
Both McCorkle and the Reverend Macmillan had tried to persuade him to return to them the day before, to take his place at the service of ordination. But he could not. Could not spare hours to such a thing. Couldn't possibly engage himself to undertake the commitment with anything less than a single mind. And while his mind was in fact single just now, it wasn't toward God. There was room in his heart just now for only one thing. Brianna.
"Well, doubtless it is God's will," McCorkle said with a sigh. "Your wife, Mr. Mackenzie, there is no word of her?"
He shook his head and muttered acknowledgement of their concern, their promises to pray for him, and for the safe return of his wife. He was too much worried to find this much solace, yet still he was touched by their kindness, and parted from them with many good wishes in both directions. Roger, Jamie, and Ian walked silently back toward the inn where they had left Claire.
"Just by way of curiosity, Ian, what did you do with Forbes' ear?"
Jamie asked, breaking the silence as they turned into the wide street where the inn was.
"Oh, I have it safe, Uncle," Ian assured him, patting the small leather pouch at his belt. "What in the name of God?"
Roger stopped abruptly, then resumed.
"What do you mean to do with it?" "Keep it with me till we find my cousin," Ian said, seeming surprised that this wasn't obvious. "It will help." "It will?"
Ian nodded, serious.
"When you set about a difficult quest, if you're Ganyan Gahaga, I mean, you generally go aside for a time to fast and pray for guidance. We haven't the time to be doing that now, of course. But often, while you're doing that, you choose a talisman, or to be right about it, it chooses you."
He sounded completely matter-of-fact about this procedure, Roger noted.
"And you carry it with you through the quest, to keep the attention of the spirits upon your desire and ensure your success." "I see."
Jamie rubbed the bridge of his nose. He appeared, like Roger, to be wondering what the Mohawk spirits might make of Neil Forbes' ear.
It would probably ensure their attention, at least. "The ear. Did you pack it in salt, I hope?"
Ian shook his head.
"Nay, I smoked it over the kitchen fire at the inn last night." "Then fash yourself, Uncle Jamie. It will keep."
Roger found a perverse sort of comfort in this conversation. Between the prayers of the Presbyterian clergy and the support of the Mohawk spirits, perhaps they had a chance. But it was the presence of his two kinsmen, stalwart and determined on either side of him, that kept him in hope. They wouldn't give up until Brianna was found, no matter what it took. He swallowed the lump in his throat for the thousandth time since hearing the news, thinking of Jemmy. The little boy was safe at River Run. But how could he tell Jem that his mother was gone? Well, he wouldn't, that was all. They'd find her. In this mood of resolution, he led the way through the door of the Brewster, only to be hailed again. Roger? This time it was Claire's voice, sharp with excitement. He turned at once to see her rising from a bench in the tap room. Seated across the table from her were a plump young woman and a slightly built young man with a cap of tightly curled black hair. Manfred MacGillivray.
"I saw you before, sir, 2 days ago."
Manfred bobbed his head apologetically toward Jamie.
"Well, I hid myself, sir, and I do regret it. But, of course, I'd no way of knowing until Eppie came back from Roanoke and showed me the ring."
The ring lay on the table, its cabochon ruby casting a tiny, calm pool of ruddy light on the boards. Roger picked it up and turned it in his fingers. He barely heard the explanations that Manfred lived with a whore who made periodic expeditions to the ports near Edenton, and upon seeing the ring had overcome his sense of shame and come to find Jamie, too much overcome by this small, hard, tangible evidence of Brianna. Roger closed his fingers over it, finding the warmth of it a comfort, and came to himself in time to hear Hepzibah say earnestly, "Ocracoke, sir, at the dark of the moon." She coughed modestly, ducking her head. "The lady did say, sir, as you might feel some gratitude for the news of her whereabouts."
"You'll be paid, and paid well," Jamie assured her, though he was clearly giving her no more than a fraction of his attention. "The dark of the moon," he said, turning to Ian. 10 days?
Ian nodded, his face shining with excitement.
"Aye, about that."
"She didn't ken whereabouts on Ocracoke Island this was?" he asked the whore.
Eppie shook her head.
"Nay, sir, I ken Stephen's got a house there, a large one, hidden in the trees, but that's all." "We'll find it."
Roger's own voice surprised him. He hadn't meant to speak aloud. Manfred had been looking uneasy throughout. He leaned forward, putting his hand on top of Eppie's.
"Sir, when you do find it, you'll not say to anybody, will you, about Eppie telling you? Mr. Bonnet's a dangerous man, and I wouldn't have her in peril from him."
He glanced at the young woman, who blushed and smiled at him.
"No, we won't say anything about her," Claire assured him.
She had been scrutinising both Manfred and Hepzibah carefully while they talked, and now leaned across the table to touch Manfred's forehead, which showed a stippling of some sort of rash. "Speaking of peril, she's in a great deal more danger from you, young man, than from Stephen Bonnet. Did you tell her?" Manfred went a little paler, and for the first time Roger noticed that the young man looked truly ill, his face thin and deeply lined.
"I did, Frau Claire, from the first."
"Oh, about the pox?" Hepzibah affected nonchalance, though Roger could see her hand tighten on Manfred's.
"Ah, he did tell me, but I says to him as it makes no difference.
I dare say I've had a few men what are poxed before, not knowing. If I should get it, well, God's will, innit?"
"No," Roger said to her, quite gently, "it isn't. But you'll go with Mrs. Clare, you and Manfred both, and do exactly what she tells you. You'll be all right, and so will he."
"Won't they?" he asked, turning to Clare suddenly, a little uncertain.
"Yes, they will," she said dryly. "Fortunately, I have quite a bit of penicillin with me."
Manfred's face was a study in confusion.
"But do you mean, meine Frau, that you can
cure it?"
"That is exactly what I mean," Claire assured him, "as I tried to tell you before you ran away." His mouth hung open and he blinked. Then he turned to Hepzibah, who was staring at him in puzzlement.
"Liebchen, I can go home. We can go home,"
he amended quickly, seeing her face change. "We will be married. We will go home," he repeated, in the tones of one seeing a beatific vision, but not quite trusting in its reality yet. Eppy was frowning in uncertainty.
"I'm a whore, Freddy," she pointed out.
"And from the stories you tell about your mother,
I rather think that Frau Utter will be so happy to have Manfred back that she won't be disposed to ask too many questions," Claire said, with a glance at Jamie. "The prodigal son, you know?"
"You won't need to be a whore any longer," Manfred assured her. "I'm a gunsmith. I'll earn a good living. Now that I know I shall be living."
His thin face was suddenly suffused with joy, and he flung his arms around Eppie and kissed her.
"Oh," she said, flustered, but looking pleased. "Well, this penny?"
She looked inquiringly at Claire.
"The sooner the better," Claire said, standing up. "Come with me."
Her own face was a little flushed, Roger saw, and she put out a quick hand to Jamie, who took it and pressed it hard.
"We'll go and see to things," he said, glancing at Ian and Roger in turn. "With luck, we'll sail this evening."
"Oh!"
Eppie had already stood up to follow Claire, but at this reminder of their business, she turned to Jamie, a hand to her mouth.
"Oh, I've thought of the one more thing."
Her pleasant, round face was puckered in concentration.
"There are wild horses that run near the house, on Ocracoke. I heard Stephen speak of them once."
She looked from one man to the other. "Might that help?"
"It might," Roger said. "Thank you, and God bless you."
It wasn't until they were outside, heading for the docks again, that he realized the ring was still clutched tight in his hand.
"What was it?" Ian had said.
"You choose a talisman, or, to be right about it, it chooses you."
His hands were slightly bigger than Brianna's, but he pushed the ring onto his finger and closed his hand around it. She woke from a damp and restless sleep, mother's sense at once aroused. She was halfway out of bed, moving by instinct toward Jemmy's trundle, when a hand grabbed her wrist, a convulsive grip like the bite of a crocodile. She jerked back, groggy and alarmed. The sound of footsteps came to her from the deck overhead, and she realized, belatedly, that the sound of distress that had wakened her hadn't come from Jemmy, but from the darkness at her side.
"Don't go," he whispered,
and the fingers dug deep into the soft flesh of her inner wrist. Unable to wrench free, she reached out with the other hand to push him away. She touched damp hair, hot skin, and a trickle of wetness, cool and surprising, on her fingers.
"What is it?" she whispered back,
and leaned toward him by instinct. She reached again, touched his head, smoothed his hair, all the things she had waked prepared to do. She felt her hand rest on him and thought to stop, but didn't. It was as though the spurt of maternal comfort, once called forth, couldn't be pressed back into her, no more than the spurt of breast milk summoned by an infant's cry could be recalled to its source.
"Are you all right?"
She kept her voice low and as impersonal as the words allowed. She lifted her hand, and he moved, rolling toward her, pressing his head hard against the curve of her thigh.
"Don't go," he said again,
and caught his breath in what might have been a sob. His voice was low and rough, but not as she had ever heard it before.
"I'm here."
Her trapped wrist was growing numb. She laid her free hand on his shoulder, hoping he would let go if she seemed willing to stay. He did relax his grip, but only to reach out and seize her by the waist, pulling her back into bed. She went because there was no choice, and lay in silence, bonnets breathing harsh and warm on the back of her neck. At length he let go and rolled onto his back with a sigh, allowing her to move. She rolled onto her own back, cautious, trying to keep a few inches between them.
Moonlight came through the stern windows in a silver flood, and she could see the silhouette of his face, catch the glint of light from forehead and cheek as he turned his head.
"Bad dream?" she ventured. She'd meant to sound sarcastic, but her own heart was still tripping fast from the alarm of the awakening, and the words had a tentative sound.
"Aye, aye," he said with a shuddering sigh. "The same. It comes to me over and over again, see? You'd think I know what it was about and wake, but I never do. Not till the waters close over my head."
He rubbed her hand under his nose, sniffing like a child.
"Oh."
She didn't want to ask for details, didn't want to encourage any further sense of intimacy.
What she wanted, though, had nothing much to do with things anymore.
"Since I was a lad, I've dreamed of drowning," he said,
and his voice, normally so assured, was unsteady.
"The sea comes in, and I cannot move. Not at all. The tide's rising, and I know it will kill me, but there's no way to move."
His hand clutched the sheet convulsively, pulling it away from her.
"It's grey water, full of mud, and there are blind things swimming in it. They're waiting on the sea to finish its business with me, see? And then they've business of their own."
She could hear the horror of it in his voice, and was torn between wanting to edge further away from him and the ingrained habit of offering comfort.
"It was only a dream," she said at last, staring up at the boards of the deck, no more than 3 feet above her head. "If only this were a dream."
"Ah, no," he said,
and his voice had dropped a little more than a whisper in the darkness beside her.
"Ah, no. It's the sea herself, calling me, see?"
Quite suddenly he rolled toward her, seizing her and pressing her hard against him. She gasped, stiffening, and he pressed harder, responding shark-like to her struggles. To her own horror, she felt Leroy rising and forced herself to be still. Panic and the need to escape his dream might all too easily make him forget his aversion to having sex with pregnant women. And that was the very last thing, the very last thing.
"Shh," she said firmly,
and clutched him round the head, forcing his face down into her shoulder, patting him, stroking his back.
"Shh. It'll be all right. It was only a dream. I won't let it hurt you. I won't let anything hurt you. Hush. Hush now."
She went on patting him, her eyes closed, trying to imagine herself holding Jemmy after such a nightmare, quiet in their cabin, the hearth-fire low, Jem's little body relaxing in trust, the sweet little boy smell of his hair near her face.
"I won't let you drown," she whispered. "I promise. I won't let you drown."
She said it over and over, and slowly, slowly, his breathing eased, and his grip on her slackened as sleep overcame him. Still she repeated it, a soft, hypnotic murmur, her words half lost in the sound of water hissing past the side of the ship. And she spoke no longer to the man beside her, but to the slumbering child within. "I won't let anything hurt you. Nothing will hurt you. I promise." Chapter 106. Rendezvous. Roger paused to wipe the sweat out of his eyes. He tied a folded kerchief round his head, but the humidity in the thick growth of the tidal forest was so high that sweat formed in his eye sockets, stinging and blurring his vision. From a tap room in Edenton, the knowledge that Bonnet was, or would be, on Ocracoke, had seemed all heady conviction. The search narrowed suddenly to one tiny sandbar versus the millions of other places the pirate could have been. How difficult could it be? Once on the bloody sandbar, the perspective had altered. The frigging island was narrow, but several miles long, with large patches of scrub forest, and most of its coastline fraught with hidden bars and dangerous eddies. The skipper of the fishing boat they'd hired had got them there in good time. Then they'd spent 2 days sailing up and down the length of the damn thing, looking for possible landing spots, likely pirate hideouts, and herds of wild horses. So far, none of these had appeared. Having spent long enough retching over the side, Claire hadn't brought her acupuncture needles, having not foreseen the need of them. Jamie had insisted upon being put ashore. He would walk the length of the island, he said, keeping an eye out for anything untoward. They could pick him up at sundown.
"And what if you run smack into Stephen Bonnet all on your own?" Claire had demanded when he refused to allow her to accompany him.
"I'd rather be run through than puked to death," was Jamie's elegant reply. "And besides, Sassenach, I need you to stay here and make sure yon misbegotten son of a captain doesn't sail away without us, aye?"
So they had rowed him ashore and left him watching as he strode away, staggering only slightly into the thicket of scrub pines and palmetto. Another day of frustration, spent sailing slowly up and down the coast, seeing nothing but the occasional ramshackle fishing shack. And Roger and Ian had begun to see the wisdom of Jamie's approach as well.
"See yon houses?"
Ian pointed at a tiny cluster of shacks on the shore.
"If you want to call them that, yes."
Roger shaded his hand over his eyes to look, but the shacks looked deserted.
"If they can get boats off there, we can get one on. Let's go ashore and see, will the folk there tell us anything?"
Leaving Claire glowering behind them, they had rowed ashore to make inquiries, to no avail. The only inhabitants of the tiny settlement were a few women and children, all of whom heard the name Bonnet and scuttled into their homes like clams digging into the sand. Still, having felt solid ground under their feet, they were less than eager to admit defeat and go back to the fishing smack.
"Let's have a look then," Ian had said, gazing thoughtfully into the sun-striped forest. "We'll crisscross, aye?"
He drew a quick series of X's in the sand in illustration.
"We'll cover more ground and meet up every so often. Whoever reaches the shore first each time will wait on the other."
Roger had nodded agreement, and with a cheery wave at the fishing boat and the small indignant figure on its bow, had turned inland. It was hot and still under the pines, and his progress was impaired by all sorts of low bushes, creepers, patches of sandburrs, and other stickery things. The going was a little easier near the shore, as the forest thinned and gave way to stretches of coarse sea oats, with dozens of tiny crabs that scuttled out of his way, or occasionally crunched under his feet. Still, it was a relief to move, to feel that somehow he was doing something, was making progress toward finding Bree, though he admitted to himself that he wasn't sure exactly what they were looking for. Was she here? Had Bonnet arrived on the island already? Or would he be coming in a day or two, at the dark of the moon, as Hepzibah had said? Despite the worry, the heat, and the millions of gnats and mosquitoes, they didn't bite for the most part, but insisted upon crawling into his ears, eyes, nose, and mouth. He smiled at the thought of Manfred. He'd been praying for the boy ever since his disappearance from the ridge, that he might be restored to his family. Granted, to find him firmly attached to an ex-prostitute was likely not quite the answer to prayer that Uta MacGillivray had been hoping for, but he'd learned before that God had his own methods.
"Lord, let her be safe."
He didn't care how that prayer was answered, provided only that it was.
"Let me have her back, please."
It was well past mid-afternoon, and his clothes stuck to him with sweat, when he came to one of the dozens of small tidal inlets that cut into the island like the holes in Swiss cheese. It was too wide to leap across, so he made his way down the sandy bank and into the water. It was deeper than he'd thought. He was up to his neck by mid-channel, and had to swim a few strokes before he found solid footing on the other side. The water pulled at him, rushing toward the sea. The tide had begun to turn. Likely the inlet would be much shallower when the tide was out, but he thought a boat could make it up the inlet easily with the tide coming in. That was promising. Encouraged, He crawled out on the far side and began to follow the channel inland. Within minutes, he heard a sound in the distance and stopped dead, listening. Horses. He would swear it was a sound of neighing, though so far away he couldn't be sure of it. He turned in a circle, trying to locate it, but the sound had vanished. Still, it seemed a sign, and he pushed on with renewed vigour, frightening a family of raccoons washing their meal in the water of the channel. But then the inlet began to narrow, the water level dropping to no more than a foot, and then less, only a few inches of water running clear over dusky sand. He was loath to give up, though, and shoved his way under a low canopy of pine and twisted scrub oak. Then he stopped dead, skin tingling from scalp to sole. Four of them. Crude stone pillars, pale in the shadow of the trees. One stood actually in the channel itself, tilted drunkenly by the action of the water. Another, on the bank, had carvings on its face, abstract symbols that he didn't recognize. He stood frozen, as though they were live things that might see him if he moved. It seemed abnormally silent. Even the insects seemed temporarily to have deserted him. He had no doubt that this was the circle the man Donna had described to Brianna. Here the five men had chanted, walked their pattern, and turned, passing to the left of the inscribed stone. And here, at least one of them had died. A profound shiver ran through him, despite the oppressive heat. He moved at last, very carefully, backing away as though the stones might wake, but didn't turn his back on them until he was a good distance away, so far away that the stones were lost to sight, buried in the heavy growth. Then he turned and walked back toward the sea, fast and then faster, till the breath burned in his throat, feeling as though invisible eyes bored into his back. I sat in the shade of the forecastle, sipping cool beer and watching the shore. Just like bloody men, I thought, frowning at the tranquil stretch of sand. Charge in pig-headed, leaving the women to mind the store. Still, I wasn't so sure that I would have wanted to slog the length of the beastly island on foot myself. By repute, Blackbeard and a number of his confederates had used the place as a lair, and the reason why was obvious. A less hospitable shore I'd seldom seen. The chance of finding anything in that secretive wooded place by randomly poking into holes was low. Still, sitting on my bum in a boat while Brianna was dealing with Stephen Bonnet was making me twitch with anxiety and the urgent desire to do something. But there was nothing to do, and the afternoon wore slowly away. I watched the shore steadily. Now and then I would see Roger or Ian pop out of the undergrowth. Then the two of them would confer briefly before popping back in. Now and then I looked to the north, but there was no sign of Jamie. Captain Rourke, who was, in fact, a misbegotten son of a poxed whore, as he cheerfully admitted himself, sat down with me for a time and accepted a bottle of beer. I congratulated myself on my forethought in having brought a few dozen, a few of which I put over the side in a net to keep cool. The beer was doing a lot to soothe my impatience, though my stomach was still knotted with worry. "None of your men are what you might call sailing men, are they?" Captain Rourke observed after thoughtful silence. "Well, Mr. Mackenzie spent a bit of time on fishing boats in Scotland," I said, dropping an empty bottle into the net. "But I wouldn't say he's an able seaman, no." "Ah." He drank a bit more. "All right," I said finally. "Why?" He lowered his bottle and belched loudly, then blinked. "Oh, well, ma'am, I believe I did hear one of the young men say as how there was a rendezvous to occur at Darkermoon." "Yes," I said, a little guardedly. We had told the captain as little as possible, not knowing whether he might have some association with Bonnet. "The Dark of the Moon is tomorrow night, isn't it?" "It is," he agreed. "But what I mean to say is, when one says Dark o' Moon, most likely one does mean night time, eh?" He peered into the empty neck of his bottle, then lifted it, and blew thoughtfully across it, making a deep whoog sound. I took the hint and handed him another.
"Thank you kindly, ma'am,"
he said, looking happy.
"See, the tide turns about 11:30 this time of month. And it's going out,"
he added with emphasis.
I gave him a blank look.
"Well, if you look careful, ma'am, you'll see the tide is half out now."
He pointed toward the south.
"Yet there's middling deep water close to shore all along here. Come the night time, though, it won't be."
"Yes?"
I was still missing his point, but he was patient.
"Well, with the tide out, it's easier to see the bars and inlets, sure. And were you coming in with a boat with a shallow draft, that would be the time to choose. But what's the rendezvous to be with something bigger? Maybe anything that draws more than 4 feet? Well, then..."
He took a gulp and pointed the bottom of his bottle toward a spot far down the shore.
"The water there is deep, ma'am. See the colour of it? Was I a ship of any size, that would be the safest place to anchor when the tide is on the ebb."
I regarded the spot he'd indicated. The water was distinctly darker there, a deeper blue-grey than the waves surrounding it.
"You could have told us that earlier," I said, with a certain note of reproach.
"So I could, ma'am," he agreed cordially, "save for not knowing as you'd like to hear it."
He got up then, and wandered toward the stern, an empty bottle in hand, absently going whoog, 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 like a distant foghorn. As the sun sank into the sea, Roger and Ian appeared on the shore, and Captain Rourke's hand, Moses, rowed ashore to fetch them off. Then we hoisted sail and made our way slowly up the coast of Ocracoke until we found Jamie waving from a tiny spit of sand. Anchored offshore for the night, we exchanged notes of our findings, or lack of them. All the men were drained, exhausted from heat and searching, and with little appetite for supper, despite their exertions. Roger, in particular, looked drawn and pale, and said almost nothing. The last sliver of the waning moon rose in the sky. With a minimum of conversation, the men took their blankets and lay down on deck, asleep within minutes. Quantities of beer notwithstanding, I was wide awake. I sat beside Jamie, my own blanket wrapped about my shoulders against the coolness of the night wind, watching the low black mystery of the island. The anchorage Captain Rourke had pointed out to me was invisible in the darkness. Would we know, I wondered, if a ship were to come tomorrow night? In fact, it came that night. I woke in the very early morning, dreaming of corpses. I sat up, heart pounding, to see Rourke and Moses at the rail and a dreadful smell in the air. It wasn't a smell one would ever forget, and when I got to my feet and went to the rail to look, I wasn't at all surprised to hear Rourke murmur, "Slaver," nodding toward the south. The ship was anchored 1/2 mile or so away, its masts black against the paling sky. Not a huge ship, but definitely too big to make its way into the small channels of the island. I watched a long time, joined by Jamie, Roger, and Ian as they woke, but no boats were lowered.
"What do you suppose it's doing there?"
Ian said. He spoke in a low voice. The slave ship made everyone nervous. Rourke shook his head. He didn't like it either.
"Damned if I know," he said. "Wouldn't expect such a thing in such a place. Not at all."
Jamie rubbed a hand across his unshaven chin. He hadn't shaved in days, and green-faced and hollow-eyed beneath the stubble, he'd vomited over the rail within minutes of rising, though the swell was very gentle, looked even more disreputable than Rourke himself.
"Can you lay us alongside her, Mr. Rourke?"
he said, eyes on the slave ship. Roger glanced at him sharply.
"You don't suppose Brianna's aboard? If she is, we'll find out. If she's not, we'll maybe find out who yon ship has come to see."
It was full daylight by the time we came along the ship, and there were a number of hands on deck, all of whom peered curiously down over the rail at us. Rock hallooed up, asking permission to come aboard. There was no immediate response to this, but after a few minutes, a large man with an air of authority and an ill-tempered face appeared.
"What do you want?" he called down.
"To come aboard," Rock bellowed back.
"No, shove off."
"We're here in search of a young woman," Roger called up. "We should like to ask you a few questions."
"Any young women on this ship are mine,"
the captain, if that's what he was, said definitely.
"Bugger off," I said.
He turned and gestured to his hands, who scattered at once, reappearing in moments with muskets. Roger cupped his hands to his mouth. "Brianna," he bellowed. "Brianna!" One man raised his gun and fired, the ball whistling safely over our heads and ripping through the mainsail.
"Oi!" shouted Rourke, incensed. "What's the matter of you?"
The only answer to this was a fusillade of further shots, followed by the opening of the port lids nearest us, and the sudden appearance of the long black noses of several cannon, along with a more intense gust of stink.
"Jesus God!" said Rourke, astonished. "Well, if that's how you feel about—" "Well, God damn you!" he shouted, brandishing a fist. "God damn you, I say!"
Moses, less interested in rhetoric, had made sail with the first shot, and was already at the tiller. We slid past the slave ship and into clean water within moments.
"Well, something's going on," I remarked, looking back at the ship, "whether it's to do with Bonnet or not."
Roger was clinging to the rail, his knuckles white.
"It is," Jamie said.
He wiped a hand across his mouth and grimaced.
"Can you keep in sight of her, but out of range, Mr. Rourke?"
A fresh wave of the smell of sewage, corruption, and hopelessness hit us, and he turned the colour of rancid suet.
"And maybe upwind, too?"
We were obliged to sail well out into the ocean and tack to and fro in order to meet these various conditions, but at length had beaten our way back and anchored a safe distance away, the slave ship barely visible. Here we lay through the rest of the day, taking it in turns to keep an eye on the strange ship through Captain Rourke's telescope. Nothing happened, though. No boats came from the ship, nor from the shore. And as we all sat silent on deck, watching the stars come out in a moonless sky, the ship was swallowed by the dark. Chapter 107. The Dark of the Moon. They anchored long before dawn, and a small boat took them ashore.
"Where is this?"
she asked, voice rusty with disuse. Bonnet had wakened her in the dark. They had made three stops along the way, at nameless coves where mysterious men came out of the shrubbery rolling barrels or carrying bales, but she hadn't been taken off at any of them. This was a long, low island, thick with scrub forest and hazy with mist, looking haunted under a dying moon.
"Ukrakook," he answered, leaning forward to peer into the fog. "A bit farther to Port Dennis."
The seaman at the oars leaned harder to the side, and the nose of the boat turned slowly, drawing nearer to the shore. It was cold on the water. She was grateful for the thick cloak he had wrapped round her before handing her into the boat. Even so, the chill of the night and the open sea had little to do with the small, constant shiver that made her hands tremble and numbed her feet and fingers. Soft murmurs between the pirates, further direction. Bonnet jumped off into waist-deep muddy water and waded into the shadows, pushing aside the heavy growth, so that the water of the hidden inlet showed suddenly, a smooth, dark gleam before them. The boat nosed its way under the overhanging trees, then paused, so that Bonnet could push himself over the gunwales, splashing and dripping. A shattering cry sounded near them, so close that she jerked, heart pounding, before realizing that it was only a bird somewhere in the swamp around them. Otherwise, the night was quiet, save for the muted, regular splash of the oars. They had put Josh and the Fulani men into the boat, too. Josh sat at her feet, a hunched black form. He was shivering. She could feel it. Disengaging a fold of the cloak, she put it over him and put a hand on his shoulder under it, meaning to give him what encouragement she could. A hand rose and settled softly over hers, squeezing, and thus linked, they sailed slowly into the dark unknown beneath the dripping trees. The sky was lightening by the time the boat reached a small landing and streaks of rose-tinted cloud reached across the horizon. Bonnet hopped out and reached down to take her hand. Reluctantly, she let go of Josh and stood up. There was a house, half hidden in the trees. Made of grey clapboards, it seemed to sink into the remnants of fog, as though it weren't quite real and might disappear at any moment. The windborne stink, though, was real enough. She'd never smelled it before herself, but had heard her mother's vivid description of it, and recognised it instantly, the smell of a slaver anchored offshore. Josh recognised